Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
And you're very welcome along to this week's episode of Friday Night Racing. It's Ger Gilroy and Johnny Ward with you every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. We broadcast live across all of our social channels on OTB Sports and on the OTB Sports app. You can get us on Facebook and Periscope or YouTube if that's how you prefer to consume your media these days. We're also then live every Friday evening from 8 o'clock. On Off the Ball on News Talk. Friday Night Racing on Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie and check out the Twitter account at HRI Racing. Johnny, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. It was a big week and a difficult week for racing. So we should get straight to the start of the story. Viking Horde, as we know now, was laid heavily in Tremore in late 2018 and was later found to have a sedative in his system. And the IHRB published their findings this week and have banned the trainer, Charles Burns, for 6 months as a result of this case. They haven't...
Yeah.
Go on.
It should be. Obviously, it's prudent to point out, I think, Charles Burns got a six-month suspension effectively on the basis that he and his son, Carl, had left the gelding sort of unattended in the stable yard in Tremor by basically going for a cup of tea or whatever. And so the six-month ban came in on that because there was no proof whatsoever of anything else. So I guess what the IHRB did was, and, you know, it produced a really, really lengthy summary of the case, which I think it needs to be definitely lauded for. It was fascinating reading, and the level of detail was really, really impressive. That's, you know, and maybe you might argue that, well, in the space of over 2 years, they could certainly have had the time to do this, but it was impressive. I guess if you read the conclusion of it, it comes to the point that there's no proof that, in terms of what happened to the horse was administered a sedative. The question is, we don't know who administered the sedative, but Charles Burns was effectively done on the fact that he'd left the horse unattended, and he's going to appeal the case, and he's perfectly entitled to do it as such.
Yeah, and so look, we're not going to get into the ins and outs of that part of it, because beyond who actually ends up being found, if anybody ever is found to have administered the sedative, one line sticks out from the findings. Significant actual damage flowed from the neglect of the trainer. The damage was financial in the case of affected punters and reputational in the case of the racing industry. Well, let's take those two parts separately. The affected punters, anybody who had a bet in that race, in particular on Viking Horde, the horse was nobbled, and so therefore you did not get fair run for your money.
I don't know what price Burnley were, you know, to beat Liverpool last night. It was probably a pretty big price, but, you know, you had that bet on in good faith and you were confident that, you know, if Liverpool had an off night, maybe Burnley could somehow win, which they did. Now, Viking Horde that morning in the betting was something like 2-1, and then he opened up at 4-1 on track and he was sent off 8-1. But more importantly, I think he was sent off 16.5-1 or thereabouts on Betfair. The 2-1 would imply that he had a 33% chance of winning, roughly. 4-1 would imply that he had a 20% chance of winning. 8-1 would imply that he had an 11% chance of winning. And the price he went off would imply that he had roughly a 6% chance of winning, when in fact he had less than no percent chance of winning because the horse could barely jump a hurdle and he was that sedated. His levels of sedative were totally off the charts. And whoever administered this to the animal basically did an awful, awful thing to that animal and endangered the life of the animal and the jockey on the animal and also anyone basically around the animal who somehow in his own bravery and, you know, being subservient to the masters that we are, the human masters, he basically tried to do his best he could despite the fact that he was dosed with sedative. And the less relevant point of all this, as you referenced there, is the fact that if you backed this horse, you had absolutely no chance, whether you had €5, €10 or €1,000, or if you backed it to place even. And if you backed it to place, you might have thought you had a chance. You had absolutely no chance. And this all came out in the case.
Yeah, and so that's the bit that it leads to the second part, which is the reputational, the damages, the reputational, in this case, to the racing industry. Reputation is such a difficult thing to define because it is so delicate. Anything can have an impact on it and anything can linger with people. And sports in particular, the whole issue of doping or match fixing or any of those things that we kind of tend to all put under the same umbrella. You've got to be very careful. You very difficult to win something back, very easy to lose it.
Yeah, and quite reasonably, some punters, you know, might look at this case and say, I'm not going to bet on horses again because how can I have faith? Now, I would argue against that in the sense that this is a case that's very much an outlier. This does not go on. Sedatives are not given to horses to stop them performing. This was like we may have, you know, a lot of chat about performance enhancing drugs given to horses, which again is it's debatable how prevalent that is, but this is completely different. This is like comparing two different, you know, I don't know, it's completely different. And what this was basically, somebody stopped this horse, presumably for financial gain. And if you were, you know, a punter in that race, granted, you benefited if you backed anything else in the race, but how could you have faith? And I think that's why the IHRB was stressing that very much and went to such lengths. I mean, the press release was 14 pages long or whatever, and it went to such lengths to really... I suppose, emphasize how severe this case is in terms of reputational damage. The amount of taxi drivers I've had and tell me I'll never have a bet on racing, you know, and I'll never have a bet on racing. And if I got into a taxi driver on Tuesday night, if I got into a taxi on Tuesday night, this case wouldn't have done me any favors.
On that side of things, how then do you make sure that everybody understands that the work was done in this case, and the right response has happened, that they found out that this horse had been novelled?
There was in the press release, there was mention of match fixing in the press release in relation to an account, a far flung account, and that's worth reading as well. And just to bring that up, that, you know, I've had bets in football games where the games were actually fixed. So racing is not like, it's not alone in the sense that, you know, scurrilous things can go on, and it is difficult. It's difficult to police every horse that goes into a race to make sure that horse comes there in peak condition. And I think what comes out of this is maybe the use of CCTV. There wasn't CCTV on the day in Tramore, and as much as nothing really goes on in the stable yards, but in this instance, that horse was left unattended for 20-25 minutes. So it was possible for somebody, and I've no idea who it was, but it was possible for somebody, because it was agreed by basically all parties that the sedative was administered at the track at Tramore. So it was possible for someone to do that. So I guess racing needs to go to more lengths to ensure that this doesn't happen. It was pointed out to me during the week that if you go to the stable areas at a French race meeting, it's really lax. You can practically bring your baby in and kiss the horse before he goes out to run, and that's because they have a kind of a toed system for their betting. They don't have the betting exchanges, and rightly or wrongly, Ger, betting exchanges have allowed you to bet on a horse, an individual horse, not to win and profit from it. And the outcome of that, as much as I laud the betting exchanges, the outcome of that is the possibility to do something like this.
Well, isn't there a responsibility on the exchanges then in an instance like this? That was one of the details that came across. So it was the IHRB deputy head of security, Declan Buckley, who was providing evidence about the laying of the bets. They were initially placed with a limited liability company, which placed them in turn with Betfair. So this is a white label. We think they don't say in the Far East, but they do say far in a faraway part of the world. So the implication, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the deepest depths.
It was Asia anyway.
Well, look, I mean, you know, it could be the jungles of Brazil. We don't know.
Yeah.
The same account previously laid bets on the same horse at Sedgefield in October 2018, risking over $30,000 to win 12. At Galway in July 2018, risking $55,000 to win 12. And an unnamed individual known to be associated with the account was described as being based in a distant part of the world and was said to be associated with match fixing and associated betting in connection with other sports. Now, I can see how the IHRB take their investigation to the point where they're like, okay, well, we've found something pretty hot here, and what happens next? Like, it's actually a gig for Interpol, but it's also a gig for the exchange to say, okay, well, we need to find out what's going on here because this is having an impact on the sporting integrity of races in Tramore and in Sedgefield and in Galway.
Yeah, you mentioned Tramore, Galway and Sedgefield, and I think that's very important because, you know, Christianity is based on Jesus being on the cross. Nobody forgets, nobody remembers that there were two other guys there and one was either side of him. Sedgefield and Galway are not irrelevant races by any stretch. And the fact this is mentioned in the IHRB case because this unknown individual was betting on those three races in terms of Viking Horde's performance. So, you know, that is, according to the IHRB, that is fact. Now, the White Label account... I got to be honest, and maybe I'm failing here, but I didn't know what a White Label account was until I heard this case. But effectively, a White Label account is you bet directly into the Betfair market, but the interface of the website is attuned to that local area, which I presume means maybe different digits, maybe different scripts. And it, just say, for example, if we're in Thailand or something like that, that it would look like kind of a Thai Betfair. But Betfair... after this case, and I'm not sure if this were later or not, they removed the possibility of laying horses on the White Label accounts. You can only bet on horses. So effectively, an individual could, with apparent impunity, get involved some exotic location in a race in Tramore when for some reason he or she thought that it was a good reason or that it was a good idea to bet that Viking Horde wouldn't run well. And Betfair changed its rules since then. And it's very, very unsatisfactory that this could happen. You mentioned Interpol there. For me, there's definitely a lot more to this than racing because you're basically depriving people of money unfairly, and there's an awful lot going on. And notwithstanding the fact that somebody loaded a horse with sedative and then asked him to run a race with a load of other horses.
Yeah, and so one final point: the IHRB came in for some criticism over Christmas. Their chief executive or their chair was on RT Racing with Hugh Cahill, and he came in for a bit of criticism afterwards for the performance that day. There's been a marked change, it appears, in their communication strategy in that they've gone to as much detail as they possibly can in this. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that was in relation to an article that I thought was very, very unfair on Joseph O'Brien, to be honest, because it looked at two cases and how they were dealt with. But, you know, Joseph put stuff in an article, basically, that was clearly not on the record and then was in the article. There was a whole furore afterwards. Dennis Egan hasn't been giving many interviews because the IHRB now has a spokesman, and Dennis Egan, who I've always found really good to deal with, he hasn't been given as many interviews. And I think that maybe affects him in a sense at Leopardstown, that he wasn't quite as... in tune in terms of quick fire answers as he was, and it wasn't probably his best performance. So that's fair enough. But I think the IHRB in this instance, if I can just go back to that as well, Jim Bulger has brought up a claim that he wants a level playing field. There isn't really any proof whatsoever of widespread drug abuse in racing. But in this instance,
if Jim Bulger is saying it, then you should investigate that, because he's been around for such a long period of time, is so well connected, is so well respected. If he's saying it, it must be an issue.
It must be an issue, but like, is it a big issue? Is it a small issue? Like, there's
What's being done to find out is the answer to that question. That's a good question. How big is the issue? Let's find out.
Yeah. From my perspective, when these cases come up, like a horse is tested positive for cobalt or he's tested positive for this and that, in my view, and this is my view, I think the IHRB are far too willing to take the trainer's word as gospel, and in that they give him the benefit of the doubt. It was like cobalt was probably given to him in the point-to-point that day, but yeah, we're not really sure. And I think sometimes it could be harsher, but there's no proof whatsoever. Horses are tested, when the Irish horses are tested all over the world. They're tested when they go to England, they're tested when they go to France, they're tested when they go to the Far East. Horses are tested and tested and tested, more so than humans, and there isn't really any evidence of this. The fact that Jim Bulger said it brought the issue to the fore, and I think we need to look at drug testing, absolutely. We need to look at hair samples, which would show, for example, in theory, if a steroid were given to a horse at any stage of his life via the hair sample. But getting away from that,
for me, the IHRB in this instance, short of interviewing everyone who had a stable pass in Tramore that day, I think it did a really, really good job. It was handicapped by the fact that it took them so long to figure out the betting implications, the betting details. It was doubly handicapped by the pandemic, which delayed things further. But for me, it was well worth the wait, because Irish racing and racing in general needed to read the 14 pages that were sent out on Tuesday, because it was so loaded, it was so significant, and it was really, really inflaming in terms of what might go on to a horse before race. And I think the IHRB deserves credit for that.
Okay, it's really fascinating stuff. I'd urge anybody who's a sports fan of any hue to get on. I mean, look, it's widely available. You can just search Viking Horde Judgment, and because the level of intrigue, and also the implications are that people are putting large sums of money on any sports event in anywhere in the world, and it's having an impact on the outcome. And look, we've seen it in League of Ireland. We're going to see it in all sports, and it's actually a big issue that I think needs to be talked about again and again and again. Okay, look, 16 minutes past 3 this afternoon. Friday Night Racing is brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. It's time for us to turn our attention to the other big story from this week, and this was the retirement of David Mullins. And I'm delighted to say David has made some time for us this afternoon. How are you getting on, David?
Hey, Joe. Very good.
So, are you feeling free and easy now that you've made the announcement about your decision?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's what I wanted to do and I've done it. So, yeah, I feel a lot better.
Is that a weight off your shoulders in some way? Like, even going public with it is a big staging post in this whole thing.
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't think it would have much of an effect. That's why I retired on Tuesday, and anyone did that, or Tuesday last week, or Wednesday maybe it was, whatever day I rode Black Bull. And, yeah, it's not that I didn't, that I kept it a secret or anything. I said it to Willie, I said it to whoever asked me, and I said it to the people I needed to tell. But I'm absolutely amazed how much has been blown out of the water.
Why do you think that is?
Because I thought anyone that kind of ever knew me should have expected it. Or anyone I've been in contact with or talked about in racing, in work, in the weigh room, and certain trainers that I've maybe rode for a bit recently, I thought I'd give off the vibes that it wasn't really for me.
Right, and yet at the same time, you were still having winners and still riding really well.
Yeah, I was still having a few winners. You know, COVID, obviously, and the injury last year. I only had 11 winners, and I don't think I have much more this season. It's grand, but it's not great.
Okay, was that one of the main reasons that in this has been coming in your head for a while? Because just reading about it, it felt like it was in your head for a good year and a half at this stage. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a tough game to get out of. Being a jockey, it's kind of, you have a fear, first of all, of what you're going to do when you do retire. And then, you know, you have a fear of, Jesus, was I not trying hard enough? Was I being lazy, not wanting to go racing, or not wanting to do stuff like that? But just the short story is that I didn't enjoy it, and it's not a game you should be in if you don't enjoy.
When did you stop enjoying it?
I couldn't put a date on it. It's obviously, you know, a lot of people are saying the injury and stuff that never really had much of an effect on it. I could have looked at it as an excuse to get out, and I did, and I thought that wasn't really the way I wanted to go out, because it was just an excuse. I wasn't fully sure I wanted to retire then, so I came back, rode for a bit, and yeah, I'm done now.
You knew that in your head at that stage it was the right call when you did come back. Just, a lot of people might not be familiar with the severity of the injury, but it was pretty bad. You ended up getting airlifted from the track.
Yeah, but airlifted, that's another thing that was blown up as well, just because you get airlifted. You know, I broke my back like plenty of other jockeys have. I'm not the first, I won't be the last. And it just happened that a helicopter came and not an ambulance. So that's another story for you.
That's very matter of fact. I know many jockeys it has happened to. I guess the rest of the world are like, wow, you know, that's pretty hardcore. And sorry, before that, you'd obviously had it in your head though, at some point. So it kind of predates even that, really, does it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the summer was always a lean time for me. And then always around the stall and Galway, they're long treks in the car, and you might be only going for one or two rides. And I got down to the stall I'd say twice in the last 4 years where I only had one ride, and when I got there, it was a non-runner. So, you know, things like that, it just, I struggled to see the pluses or the benefits or the gains from it for a while. And if you're a jockey, you should be loving to do that anyway. I just didn't.
I don't know. So, Dave, like a jockey at 24, you know, just kind of retiring is noteworthy. Like a jockey maybe with the Mullins name, you know, at 24 retiring is kind of like somebody leaving the Amish community. It just doesn't happen. So you were steeped in racing from your grandfather, your grandmother, your father, and basically the entire family, bar George, who's involved in the industry, all involved in racing. It was basically laid out for you that you were going to be a jockey. You win the Grand National. You win an unbelievable renewal of the Savills Chase. And you're universally accepted as being very, very talented. In fact, you were probably lauded as the next big thing at one stage. How did it come to this? And is it the fact that in racing, you're stymied in terms of what you can do otherwise in life, and maybe that there is a lot more going on, or was your heart just not fully in it?
Well, my heart obviously wasn't fully in it, but that's like only it's been blown up so much and everyone started talking about and asking me and whatever. I wouldn't have ever said any of that. Like Emmett Mullins retired and went training, and there was never much about Emmett retiring from riding or anything like that, and he would have been much in a similar position as me, you know. So I can't really put my finger on it. I just don't want to be a jockey at the minute, and that's that.
That's fair enough. It's an unbelievably hard life. That's the other side of it, isn't it?
It's a tough life, yeah. There's no doubt about it. And you wouldn't do it if you didn't love it. And, you know, you hear AP McKay was talking about before he retired, when he had announced it, that he'd have done it for free for years and all that, as much as I don't think that's true. But, you know, I couldn't understand how AP was able to announce his retirement and then stay riding for another 3 or 4 months, I think, after it. You know, that must be tough to know that, you know, you're finished. Why not get out?
Yeah.
What are you waiting for?
If you could tap yourself on the shoulder as a 16-year-old now, would you say, don't do it?
No, definitely not. No regrets. Jeez, I loved being a jockey. I loved every bit of it, really. It's a great experience, but it's just the bad times probably outweigh the good times in the end. And when you're not enjoying the simple things like going racing with a chance, I used to love doing all that. But now I kind of didn't see it anymore, so it wasn't really for me.
And at the bad time, go on, sorry, Johnny.
Sorry, Ger, was that a hard thing to deal with? Because like if you go on and if you're one of the very privileged to win a Grand National, and was it a difficult thing to reconcile with yourself that you're going racing and even despite your tender years, the love is just not there and you've no real, I guess you've no answer for that.
Yeah, I don't really have an answer for it, yeah.
And like, I know what's interesting to me is that you're friendly with Brian Cooper and Mikey Fogarty. Mikey Fogarty retired before, and Brian wouldn't have maybe as many rides as like he could have, and he'd take a more selective approach to the mounts he have. Is there something significant that the three of you are very close friends, and that maybe you just see like there is more to life than racing as well?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'm as good of friends with Paul Townend and Robbie Power and Danny Mullins, who are as hungry a jockey in the Wareham as I am with Brian Cooper and Mikey Fogarty. So, no, that has no difference or no meaning to me.
So it's an individual thing?
110%, yes.
What does your dad make of it?
Not much. He doesn't talk much. He wouldn't be one for discussing things with. But as I said, that's not a conversation I wanted to have really with anyone about it. I was making my own mind up, and that was me.
The lows not being worth the occasional highs is really interesting to me, because we sit and we talk on this show to jockeys all the time and relentlessly bring up the fact that if you're successful, 10 or 11 or 12% of the time that you ride a horse, you're going to get a winner, and everybody's obsessed with winning. But the rest of the time, you're losing. And how you deal with that is obviously it's an individual thing, and learning how to deal with it must be very, very difficult. Did you ever get good at dealing with being beaten on a horse?
Yeah, I was good on it, at it, but you know, I had plenty of rides, and you were back out in the next one, and that seemed to win, and you were happy enough that way. You always had a good ride to look forward to when I was riding for Henry, and even Jigginstown and Gordon, along with Woody, I was getting good spares. There was, when things were going your way, they were very good, and you always had something to look forward to. At the minute, I was riding in Willie's there. I was kind of second, third jockey. And you just don't know what's going to come next. You could be schooling a horse. You don't know who's going to ride it. You don't know what's going to happen. You might have no ride. You could, I turned down a ride Stevens' day in Leopardstown because Paul and Danny were in Limerick. I was in Leopardstown, and I presumed that I'd be riding one of Willie's, and I ended up turning down another ride because of it. But at 5-12, I wasn't down on Willie's horse, and I wasn't down on the horse I turned down either. So, you know, it's a funny game. You don't really have much decisions. You're kind of told what to ride, and if you don't, you're a bit useless.
I can see how that would be very frustrating over a period of time, particularly as you feel like your talent and hard work probably would have reached a point at this stage in your career where you had a bit more agency.
A bit more, sorry, what?
A bit more agency, a bit more, you would be in charge a bit more of your own destiny.
Yeah, I wasn't.
I'd just like to counter that though, David. Like, you're talented enough without a shadow of a doubt to be a stable jockey somewhere, so could that have happened?
No, obviously.
Why did it not happen?
A stable jockey, I don't know. I had gigs with Henry de Bromhead there, and I rode a little bit for Jigginstown and stuff like that. I stood in for Brian Cooper for 2 or 3 years or whatever it was when he was out injured. I rode second strings behind him for Jigginstown, for Mouse Morris, Henry de Bromhead when Andrew Lynch was out. I got in there for a while. You know, there was plenty of jobs I got in, but they never really stuck. And I ended up reverting back to William Mullins, who was always loyal to me and an absolute pleasure to ride for.
Do you have a plan for what comes next?
Not really. No. As I said, in racing, it's hard to get out of. So you can't, you're 100% dedicated to it. You're riding out every morning before you go racing. Even then in the summer, you think times are a bit quieter. You still can't plan anything, because if a ride does pop up or if someone does get hurt, you have to be there on call. So you can't really look into seeing if I like a different trade or seeing if even a different country or a different job might suit.
So now you're
going to... Sorry, Jerry, if you... Like, this is obviously a stupid question at the moment, but if you travelled for 3 months or 6 months and you went around the world, what odds do you want to go back to be a jockey after it?
I'll give you 150-1, Johnny, if you want.
I'll have a tenner on that. At least I'll get a better run for my money than Viking Horde as well. It's that unlikely, yeah?
Yeah, I've made my decision. I would be fairly stubborn. But you don't want to shut doors either. But it's not for me at the minute. I could not see myself coming back, no.
Well, say if you travelled, if you did your bit of travelling, do you think, I don't know if you travel much, like, would you think you'd come back with and ask you that you maybe decided there's actually something I do want to do here and it's nothing to do with racing?
No. If I went and travelled and whatever, I don't want to leave racing. I love racing. I love everything about it. I love people's opinions on horses and stuff like that. And I love the great stories that come out of it. Racing's... A very good community. You see when things go wrong for some people, how everyone comes together and tries to pull stuff out of it. My first taste of that was probably with Robbie Mack. Seeing what everyone done for him was unbelievable. And with JT McNamara, you know, I love racing, but it's just I don't want to be a jockey anymore.
Yeah, well, look, I can totally understand.
People not get that in their heads.
Yeah, that's not, but I'll tell you what it is. It's that you have had such high levels of success and you're so young. And so the other thing that's happened over the last couple of years is that great all-time class of jockey in National Hunt in Ireland has retired. And, you know, Barry Geraghty, and at the moment, we're obviously there's injury preventing the last of that great group from saddling up at the moment. But I think that a lot of people probably expected your generation to fill that gap and you to be in the vanguard of that. So people are wondering, Jesus, like, you know, big opportunity there. That's probably why it's most surprising. At the same time, you know, we talk to the jockeys all the time about making weight, about sandwiches in dodgy petrol stations on the road, about the early mornings and the late nights and the travel and the mental fragility that, like, comes with being beaten, and also just like the weight struggle. So I can totally see why you would might look for something else.
I'd have loved if I had a weight problem. I don't. I can't put on weight is my problem. I done 9.8 in the summer, I think, in Sligo. If I had a weight problem, it'd be another excuse and another reason to get out. that's the way I was looking at it. But no, you're saying there about all the, you know, the Paul Carberry's, Ruby Walsh, Barry Geraghty all leaving the sport or not riding anymore, retired, and Davey Russell out on the sidelines. And listen, his best years are definitely behind him. But I'm listening to Davey Russell telling me is that he was only collecting the last few quid and he's leaving. And I'm listening to that for 7 years.
Yes.
That opportunity of them all moving off, that didn't kind of strike you as something that you really wanted to go for? Like, that's the kind of crux of this whole thing, I suppose, is that fire is not in your belly at the moment.
No, well, I never really doubt myself against any of them. I know opportunity will come more as they leave, but I never doubted myself against them. I always thought I was well capable of riding against them. I've seen jockeys getting psyched out and beaten before race, even before they leave the weigh room. Ruby Walsh was brilliant at it. But that never fazed me or anything like that. And to be jealous of those top-class riders that did leave the sport, to be jealous of how they rode, I was never really jealous of it. The only thing I was jealous of was how they were retired with great TVs and I was still sitting in the weigh room or still going racing.
That's really interesting. I think that's why probably it has resonated with so many people. Your little brother has just, I think, taken out his license this year. Is that right?
Yeah. Charlie's taken out his license. He's riding in a few bumpers.
And is he looking at you, going, "Why am I doing this?" Or did you have a conversation with him? How did that go?
I know Charlie'd be a lot different for me. Charlie's about 6'2" or that. He's tall. He's going to be very heavy as well, I'd say. I think an amateur will suit him fine.
So that makes a lot of sense for him.
I think so. I think he'll be very good at it as well. He was always a good athlete in hurling, soccer, rugby, athletics, whatever he turned his hand to, he was always good at it. So I presume mulliking around the pine field now will suit him well as well.
Well, I think people will be familiar with him in the amazing photograph we have on the day that you did win the Grand National. You're 19 when you win the Grand National. What's your recollection? Do you remember any of the actual bits and pieces of it, or is it all a blur at this stage?
I don't really. Yeah, it was a great day. It was brilliant to win it. The excitement was unbelievable. The joy was unbelievable. But that's all in the past. I never wanted to look back at it because I said I didn't want to be the jockey. Like, there was plenty of them before who had won a national and retired in the next few years. So that's why I never really dwelt on it too much.
Now that you're retired, though, officially, you're allowed to go, "Yeah, well, I won a Grand National 19, everybody. Just don't forget." That's the totally legitimate thing to do now that you're officially retired.
And most other people would probably say, "Well, you probably should have won another one."
Tiger Roll's an all-time great horse, though. It's a, yeah.
I think you should be lauded though as well, because you were. I thought it was lovely to hear what Willie said about you, and the fact that the ride on Kenboy in particular, I think he used the word that you were a free spirit, in that when Kenboy was basically kind of doing a bit too much, you ignored instructions and went with your feel in the race and got the horse jumping and sort of took up the running miles out instead of when you were. And did you feel like, what was it like? What was that day like? How did that compare to the Grand National? Because personally, in terms of the strategy you employed, it obviously just worked out.
He was too free. He wasn't going to win from where he was or doing what I was doing. We were going too slow. I had to send him to the front. That was that's just called not being stupid. But I've lost jobs and lost rides over not doing what I'm told.
And is that something that you would stand by yourself in the sense that, like, I did what I thought was best at the time, or would you have done it differently?
Well, he won, so it was great.
In terms of the jobs you lost or whatever?
Oh, sure. Obviously, if I knew they weren't going to win doing what I was going to do on them, I wouldn't have done it. But, yeah, I've lost jobs over changing or switching to plan B.
That is the other side of this as well, is that kind of whole relationship where no one really actually knows what's happening between you and the horse in the middle of the race. You can tell them afterwards and people can obviously, you know, there's endless amounts of hours that they spent watching, so they have some idea. But ultimately, you're on the horse and you've got to make that split-second decision about what the right course of action is. Did you get better at that as time went on, making those decisions? Did they tend to work in your favour as time went on?
Yeah, you obviously know much more. You obviously gain experience in a few years and stuff like that. But did it make much difference, the decisions? I don't know. I probably got better at not really caring and going out and doing what I wanted to do anyway.
And is that another kind of element to this whole thing where, you know, there's a boss who's telling you what you have to do and then actually they're not really there when the moment of opportunity or crisis arises and you have to go ahead, and then afterwards you're explaining yourself to people who actually weren't there?
Yeah, well, you see, that's that was a problem with a lot of jockeys face. They have to do what they're told and whatever, but I'm so lucky, right, for Willie Mullins and my father. They completely understand. They don't really give instructions. The first thing they ask you in the pre-ring is, what do you think you want to do? So, you know, that's a lot of relief as well.
Yeah. Is training something that interests you?
Yeah, definitely. Not on a big scale or anything like that. I love the idea of having my own few horses and stuff like that. But no, I see my father there. He's the hardest working man I know. He's up at 7:30 every morning. He's in the yard at 7:00, sorry. And he's up there feeding them at 10 o'clock at night.
And that actually does interest you, that level of hard work. That's not the thing at all here. It's getting involved in the sport at that level is totally fine.
Yeah, no, as I said, I love the sport. I just didn't like riding the horses anymore.
The success that Emmett has had in his ephemeral enough career as a trainer, would that encourage you? Because anyone taking up training, you know, most people would say you're mad, but your cousin has done very, very well, and you probably would have a bit of backing as well because of your background in the game.
Maybe, yeah. Emmett's done fantastically well. I've brought a lot of winners from him. I think we have something like a 36% strike rate or something. But I don't know, a lot of Mullins training could be a bad thing too.
Yeah, it's in fairness though, there's like, you know, the horse runs in the race, but that's only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the horse's life, and there's so much going on in the game between breeding horses, you know, rearing them as yearlings, selling them on, and pre-training them, training them. So there's a lot of stuff there that you might get kind of a kick out of as well, which doesn't involve riding them.
Yeah, I'd love to explore now every pathway there is in racing, and not just racing, maybe even show jumping as well. My mother's side of the family are very big into that, very successful as well. So I want to just see what there is out there in horses.
And taking some time off before you do all that? I mean, it's not a great time to be taking time off, but is that the plan, or are you jumping straight in?
No, that's why I was going away to Punchestown and do it and retire then. But no, I'm still riding out in Willie's at the minute, and yeah, going around doing a few bits.
All right. Well, look, we wish you all the very best. It's you know, it sounds like it was exactly the right thing for you to do. I was going to say it's a brave decision to step away when there's so much potential left in your career. But actually, you know, fair play to you and congratulations on making the decision. And also, I know, you know, it might not feel like it, but your CV is pretty good for somebody who has won some very, very big, important races. That at some point in the future, you'll stick on the old YouTube above and go, "That's me. That was good."
Maybe. Thanks very much.
Good luck.
Should we point out now that Racing has lost its pin-up boy, would definitely be recognised as the most handsome man in the weighing room. And I said to Patrick Mullins, what would you ask your cousin if we had him on today? And his two questions were, was he born with it or was it Maybelline? And would he recommend L'Oreal?
Goodbye, Johnny.
David Mullins, good stuff. Thanks very much. It's David Mullins, who might make a good pundit too at some point, by the sounds of it, Johnny.
He's not his, he's his father's son, put it that way. I think the stubborn streak, his father would be proud of his own stubborn streak, really talented trainer. Just doesn't make sense that a 24-year-old with his CV and with his probable future should do it, but I think anyone listening to that interview would see why he did as well.
I think that's it. I think that, like, we all decide that all of life is set out very early on a path, and when Homer Simpson wears the pink shirt to the everybody goes crazy. They're like, what's going on? It's like anything that's slightly out of the norm, I'd be like, oh, what's going on? There must be something. And it's like, I want to explore other things. I'm a young person with the entire world at my feet. So I wish David Mullins all the best. And I think sometimes we've got to accommodate people, particularly the free spirits. I didn't realize that that's what Willie had said about him, but it certainly comes across there. Friday Night Racing brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. We do have to talk about where we are at the moment. Oh, I've got a competition as well, of course. Ahead of the Goss Thiestes Chase at Goran Park next Thursday, we have a sweet prize to give you something good to look forward to in 2022. It's to win overnight accommodation for you and your guest at the Langton House Hotel, including tickets to the 2022 Goss Thiestes Chase. Just tell us what jockey rode the winner of last year's race. Text your name and answer to 53106 for 30 cents. And we'll contact you after the show. So text your name and answer to 53106 for 30 cents. We'll contact you after the show. And that is, tell us who rode last year's, the winner of last year's race. And we'll put you up at the Langton House Hotel and also throw in tickets for the 2022 Goss Thiestes Chase, by which stage we will all be able to go. So that's the point. Right, there's been a shake-up, it says here, in our Tote 10 to Follow competition for the Irish Injured Jockeys Fund. I can't believe I'm not on MYLN's side. I can't believe it. That was a boo-boo on my part, but you did pick MYLN, and so obviously that was a victory for you. That win at Punchestown has you back on top. You've opened up a 16-point lead over me, so I think the Dublin Racing Festival is going to reverse that order. For all the very latest on the Tote 10 to Follow and Tote betting, see tote.ie. What's racing like this weekend, Johnny?
Racing is very good. The Irish racing on Navanon Saturday is subject to an inspection. Apparently the track's actually frozen today, so I didn't realise it was that cold. But Navan, as anyone will tell you, is the coldest place in the world.
Yes.
Pretty much. Really,
yes.
Baltic cold. That racetrack, I think it's kind of like in a valley or something. It's a massive open space. You can see a long way kind of into the distance. Whatever it is in winter, it is really, really cold. So hopefully that goes ahead. But I guess main eyes tomorrow are on Ascot. Politolog taking on the returning Defi de Soy in a fascinating renewal of the Clarence House. Now, Defi de Soy is actually 20-1 to win the Queen Mother, which might be worth looking at. He was odds on in the race last year, as much as he disappointed, but I don't know if there's that much depth to the race. But just, you mentioned Goran as well, Ger. I should mention, I was talking to Eddie Scally, the racecourse manager. He's one of the most proactive racecourse managers, and I know we live in really horrible times, but just this is kind of the cost of the difficulties on a sporting level, because he said to me, look at my director, he said, Tom Carley, he hasn't missed a Thiestes day in over 50 years, and because of his age, he can't go to Thiestes on Thursday. And it's, as much as this is neither here nor there in terms of the horrific, the deaths and so forth, it's sad that that's where we're at, and that these elder statesmen, like the Thiestes is a fantastic day's race, and a real kind of midweek rural setting, community spirit to it. The race that stops a county, and for the likes of Tom Carroll, it's tough, and I hope that he can enjoy the racing from home. And as you say, hopefully maybe next year at least we'll be able to go to it, because it's just not the same without people there, and Goran certainly won't be on Thursday.
No, I kind of hope that everybody's realising that, like, it's the people that make all these events, and that as we all get to go back to them, we're all going to be even more gagging to go, and so therefore,
yeah,
you know, that there's a surge towards the old pursuits of actually going and communing with people and seeing them again, as opposed to
totally
resorting to Zoom calls, because it's not the same.
Which which is interesting because everyone seems to want to work from home now. And I'm like, not at all. It's not the panacea. You'll eventually get really fed up with it and you'll want to see your buds or even the boss you don't like in the office anymore. But in terms of racing and going to sporting events, as you say, the clamour to actually return to it, I think it'll, and even to go to a gig, you know, if you deprive someone of something for that long, it's going to be tenfold as enjoyable when we do get back and race, and hopefully we'll benefit from that boon as well.
All right, good stuff, Johnny. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Ger.
Friday Night Racing and Off the Ball is brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. We'll see you next Friday at 3 o'clock on all
Friday
of our
Night
channels.
Racing on Off the Ball. And they're off. Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein powered chicken bites.